Good morning. Thank you for having me again. I'm obligated to disclose. I am a consultant, though I do not perceive any conflicts of interest in this presentation. I'm going to talk a little bit this morning about service-oriented architecture. It's a little bit of a techie term, but hopefully we'll be able to bridge some of the technical folks and less technical folks in the room. I must admit, when I submitted this abstract, I wasn't thinking specifically about immunization algorithms at all. But just coincidentally, the case studies that I'm going to talk about do support the decision support activities in each of these two jurisdictions. So I'll try to remember that that's the topic in mind. And it's also interesting because given some of the data from the survey that Amanda and Janet were talking about, one possible component of a technical solution that would allow IIS all around the country to share in some common algorithms or decision rules might be service-oriented architecture, because this sort of building block up approach may be the right balance of sort of autonomy for the IIS, along with some ability to call upon something more common in a standard way. So let's try to keep that in mind. So I'm going to talk a little about what at least I perceive the problem to be, a little bit about defining service-oriented architecture. Then I'm going to talk about some projects that we've worked on. You've all heard lots of presentations about the CIR in New York and KidsNet. They've both been around for more than 10 years, mature, on ongoing, evolving projects that I think will serve as good examples. What's the problem? As you know, IIS are complicated systems with lots of pieces, lots of parts, lots of moving parts. Functionality has to change and evolve. We heard a great set of presentations in the first hour today about BMI and about some other integrated components in with registries. So these are registries that are responding to things that are changing in their environment. And you have to be able to keep moving as public health keeps moving. But often changes need to be made incrementally. You don't usually get the chance, you don't usually get the money to sort of sweep away what you have and start again. Sometimes you do, but often you don't. And funding is limited. So you need to find ways to be able to move your systems forward. Sometimes quickly, sometimes flexibly. And you may find that not all the improvements that you want to make are sort of technically compatible at sort of first blanch. So thus enters service-oriented architecture. You've probably all heard and read a lot of about this. In some ways, we've been using service-oriented approaches for years, at least some of us have, even before some of these labels were put on. But at its core, we're talking about essentially a building block approach towards system design that allows you to create discrete functions as building blocks and access them as building blocks. You can create whole systems this way. You can create just little parts of systems this way. So it's not sort of an all or nothing endeavor. What are some of the benefits here? Software developed in this approach is very modular. So discrete pieces do discrete things. It means that you can then build and assemble larger, more complex systems out of these building blocks and potentially scale more easily as you have to get bigger to deal with either more complexity or more data by putting these building blocks together effectively. An objective is to try actually to reduce cost overall by creating building blocks that can be used over and over again. So if you have three systems that have to look up an address and do a standard geocoding, great to have to do that three times. Even better to implement that once and have a standard way for each of those three systems, which could be anywhere in your organization, to submit the address that has to be geocoded and get an answer back from the same place. Not only will you get a consistent answer, but you only have to write that place once. As I said, whole systems can be built in a service-oriented way, or just a particular piece of a system can be built that way, and those are going to be the examples that you're going to see. The service-oriented pieces tend to be more platform-independent, meaning they're not dependent on a particular technology to be used by every component. So because the way that you talk to a service is in a standard way, it doesn't matter if the system talking to it was created in Windows and it's talking to something that's running on Java, or vice versa. So you can build a component, reuse it, even if it's being used with different technologies. And we're going to see an example of that. It gives you some increased flexibility, because remember that geocoding example? Well, let's say something changes in the geocoding world, and you want to change that service. Well, you only have to change that service once, and all the systems that are using it automatically have the benefit of that changed, perhaps more up-to-date service. And usually with service-oriented architectures, the philosophy about doing application development and software development is through a much more speedy and modular process. Real quick, there are some limitations. Sometimes implementations can run a little slower because of the way that they have to be sent information and get in information back. The SOA components may not be as tightly coupled into your system. May be an issue, may not be an issue. With the reduction in hardware prices, usually you can overcome performance problems just with sheer horsepower. There's a lot of hype in the market about service-oriented architecture, and just because someone says it's SOA or SaaS, software as a service, it doesn't make it good, it doesn't make it bad, but it doesn't necessarily make it good. So you can certainly develop lousy services, just like you can develop lousy software using other architectures. So you have to be careful. Just because it's using the buzzwords doesn't mean that it's doing it right. Okay, so we have two quick case studies. These are both of systems and components that are in production out there right now. This first is from the CIR, the Citywide Immunization Registry. I think I saw Amy here. Is Amy here? Yeah, so I think Amy's here, or was here. One of the oldest registries in the country, probably one of the biggest registries in the country. You know, its mission is to consolidate data and help providers help children, and increasingly help adolescents and adults as well. You know, it's a pretty big registry. More than 4 million patients are in there, you know, approaching 50 million immunizations in there, with a pretty sophisticated clinical decision support system that's called ICE, I-C-E. Does evaluations for, 14 routinely administered series. Not only evaluates history for valid and invalid, but also makes recommendations and is constantly changing and evolving. We're doing another patch of it this week and another next week for some such thing. Hopefully you can see that, but it serves you right for sitting in the back of the room if you can't. CIR is actually part of a somewhat complex system, so the CIR stuff is on the right, fairly traditional database system, web server, front end, firewalled, and all that stuff, which providers access through a web client. And there are also a number of ways to submit data externally. But there's also this integration piece where the registry was integrated through a master client index or an MPI and a set of services with the lead poisoning prevention management system, which is sort of on the left. So there's a law in New York City that children have to have their blood screened for lead poisoning at 1 year of age and 2 years of age. They get lab reports fed directly into this lead poisoning prevention case management system, which is on the left. That system was used exclusively by caseworkers in the health department, but providers couldn't see that information. And similarly, the caseworkers couldn't see immunization information. So through this integration component in the middle, they can now sort of see each other's information, which is great. And in fact, they discovered that providers were starting to get portable blood lead analyzers in their offices. So now, in fact, a provider can enter a lead test in the CIR, and it gets reported to the lead program. That was sort of an interesting twist. Okay, so that's sort of the basic architecture. So what we wanted to do was to create a web service to achieve two different functions through a services-oriented architecture. Let me go back here for a second. We wanted a way for providers to submit data to the CIR electronically. Lots of data is submitted now electronically, primarily through a flat file format that was defined and declared long before HL7 even was on the scene. So it's standardized, but it's idiosyncratic to New York City. And we wanted to bring HL7 compatibility here as more and more EHR systems in New York City wanted to submit HL7 data. And we wanted to have a way for them to do that. So this is about creating a web service to sort of sit on this server as a way to add a new method for folks to submit, but without having to replace all the other processing that's done. So that was one function. But we really wanted to go beyond that, or that they wanted to go beyond that. They wanted to have a way for an EHR system to be able to ask the registry for a child's history and get that history back, also using HL7. And get back the recommendations that came from the forecaster in that same HL7 message. So we wanted to provide that functionality, but without having to redo all the components that were already functioning just fine over decisions, this ICE calculation engine. So we decided to do this using a services-oriented architecture. So what the provider system sees out there is a standard interface described in a standards-based way that they can use to either submit their immunization or submit a query and get an answer. From the CIR standpoint, we then take that question or question and answer and submission and process it through this web service. And then it just gets added into the normal processing stream of what the CIR does. So if it's a submission, it just gets submitted into the queue of stuff that's getting submitted. If it's a question that needs an answer, it just calls the same standard pieces that always answer those same questions, even for the web client. So what's involved in this? Get my slides to advance. Okay. So the first service is related to getting this question an answer. So when the question comes in through this web service, the query, which is using a standard HL7 now version 2.3.1 VXQ message, it parses the patient in information and looks for the patient. So it tries looking just first with a fairly simple search using deterministic rules. If it can't find it, it then performs a more sophisticated search against this integration engine that was in the diagram. It gets the patient's history. It then has the standard service that calculates, this ICE, calculate the recommendations, constructs the standard HL7 message, and sends it back out to the person who asked. And this is done in real time. In fact, I think there was a presentation yesterday by the folks at New York Presbyterian, right, about this. This is the other end of that presentation. This is the service they were talking to. And I think they demonstrated, or at least showed the screens of sort of how that's done in real time. The other service, which is about reporting new immunizations, again, uses a standard HL7 version 2.3.1 VXU message. The message comes in, so the web service is just sitting there saying, I'm here, send me. Again, searches for the patient, does the validation, creates a new patient record if it needs to. Otherwise, it inserts the immunizations. That may be coming across, again, all using the same standard methods and tools that other components of the CIR are used to do this. And then we'll send an acknowledgement or error message if the other system wants to see it. Okay, I need to move quickly, I think. This is about standards-based submission of new immunizations and histories, as well as access to this decision support. And this functionality was added not only compliant with national standards, without disrupting the current operation of what's a pretty big operation, and without re-architecting the whole system. We were just able to add the component that we need to and draw upon the other pieces that we need to. Let's look real quick at Rhode Island, which is a bit different. KidsNet, you know, a little different philosophy. It's an integrated system covering 10 or 12 child health programs that integrate their data together in Rhode Island and present a sort of common portal for providers to look at a variety of child health data depending on their role and their permissions. The architecture, again, not all that different. You know, a bunch of providers on the right who are accessing primarily through an application server on the web and a database sort of off there on the left. Quite a bit smaller than New York City, but still big enough. So you know, a little more than 300,000 patients, pushing on 4 million. Immunizations, but lots of data about lots of other different kinds of things. And this system also sort of evolved over a long period of time. Originally, it was a terminal-based system. Then it went to be a fully web-based system. What was their problem? A number of years ago, they didn't have a good algorithm because their algorithm had started years before and was not very sophisticated. So we sort of looked around at what was out there, looked at the prospect of building one again, and decided that, or they decided to ask another state to use the algorithm that had been incorporated in another state's product. And we then deployed that algorithm as a web service, so as a discrete service, rather than sort of munging it all into the KidsNet code. So one of the reasons why this became important is because KidsNet, just from a technical architecture standpoint, is an Oracle Linux-based system. And the web client is all Java-based. This immunization algorithm that they wanted to incorporate was Windows-based. So how do you integrate a Windows-based algorithm into a Java-based system? Well, you do it through a web service, which doesn't care what the platforms is. So all we had to change in KidsNet is that rather than call its old internal algorithm, it was going to submit a structured request to another server. It wasn't even the same architecture. It didn't know, it didn't care. So KidsNet sends this service, just the same kind of stuff that, the CDC did in their examples, the child's date of birth and their history. The service doesn't even care who the child is. It's irrelevant. I mean, the demographics of the child, other than date of birth, gender, and the child's history are the only things that are important. And it sends back its recommendations for the child, and then KidsNet can do whatever it wants with those recommendations. Okay? What's a possible future for this KidsNet service? Well, rather than have KidsNet ask this service about decision support, any system could ask this service about decision support. So think of an EHR system out there in the provider world. It could ask KidsNet, I'm sorry, it could ask the algorithm service, because it's a service, notice KidsNet isn't here at all, just the thing that has the algorithm, it could also send it a date of birth and an immunization history. There isn't even a HIPAA anything here. There's no privacy security issue. I'm not sending the child's name. The calculation algorithm doesn't care who the child is. All it needs is date of birth, gender, and immunization history. It'll give you an answer. So any system could potentially use this same service, consistent with what KidsNet is using, to ask it questions and get answers. And it doesn't matter what this EHR system is. Oracle, Linux, Windows, desktop-based, server-based, web-based, it doesn't matter. It uses a standard services interface to this service, and then the provider could theoretically get that decision support algorithm right in their EHR system, which is where they really want it anyway. I mean, face it, those who have EHR systems want to spend as much time as they can in their native system, don't really want to go out to some other web service. Yet these things can coexist. The IIS can ask questions to this service, and so can the EHR system. So what'd they get? They got a robust algorithm with no software acquisition costs. Now, I won't tell you it was effortless or free to wrap that algorithm and present it as a service. But I think they got it faster and in a more generic way, because they were able to integrate it into KidsNet, again, with sort of minimal interruption and really minimal modification to KidsNet. And it's sort of positioning KidsNet to be this sort of algorithm provider, at least the KidsNet program to be this sort of algorithm provider. And I think that's it. A number of resources there. Thanks. How do I do on time? Okay.
Questions for Noam? Come up to the microphone so we can hear you.
I'm Paul Hunter from Milwaukee, family physician. I just started in public health at the City of Milwaukee Health Department. I have a sort of comment about an aha moment I'm having about the service-oriented application. Is that what the SOA?
Service-oriented architecture.
Architecture.
SOA.
Having used electronic medical records in a private practice I worked at, and in the current practice that I still do in a nursing home setting, I now understand the delays that happen when I'm accessing certain parts of the medical record. That when you step out and look at how efficient that is for the whole system, I can intellectually understand that. However, when you're actually sitting there and waiting the 2 or 3 seconds, it's extremely painful when that 2 or 3 seconds recurs multiple times in every encounter and multiple times per day. That those few minutes per day really add up. And when the systems are stretching the hardware and software capabilities of your system, those few seconds get longer and longer the more patients you have, the more providers you have. And so I think that that downside of service-oriented architecture can, in practice, if the administration doesn't put the money behind getting the hardware and software to work rapidly, be a major impediment in actual clinical practice.
Sure. I mean, look, we've been doing support in New York City for more than 10 years. I don't even want to tell you how many times those servers have been migrated and upgraded to keep up with the demands for these services. There's another set that's in the queue now. But remember that software implemented in a traditional way can be equally crappy, and the experience of accessing it can be equally crappy. And service-oriented architecture implemented well can be quite efficient and quite worthwhile. So you have to be careful about associating cause and effect with a particular architecture, given the complexity of the.
I'm presenting a very clinical point of view, but I it's not necessarily reflecting exactly how I feel. But the flip side to my comments are that to have one place that you can make a change and everybody that accesses that from multiple place is an extreme advantage as a clinician to get rapid update of a database and have real-time update access to information that you don't have to wait months for your database. I think that's a major advantage. Thank you.
Thanks.
Thank you very much. I'm Stuart Weinberg from Vanderbilt. I had a philosophical question and a techie, geeky question, if that's okay. The philosophical question is, do you think a web service vaccine forecasting algorithm should also handle things like allergies or medications so that that you mentioned that you submit, you know, date of birth and gender, but certainly if they're allergic to eggs or if they're on prednisone or if they're immunosuppressed, that's going to affect recommendations. Do you think that should be on the web service end, or do you think the web service should return recommendations and then the calling application tweaks it with the additional information that it has?
I do recognize that those other factors, including whether they had a disease in some cases, does affect the recommendation. I haven't really thought about that quite the way that you're saying. I think it could go either way, but however you do it, it has to be clear so that you know what you're getting on the other end. I have to think about that, about where I personally would prefer to have that extra filter added for some of these other factors.
I bring that up because that could then potentially involve HIPAA issues, because you'd be sending more clinically relevant data to a web service. If you start sending allergies or sending meds or sending diagnoses, that may potentially have some HIPAA.
Yeah, but if it's still de-identified, I mean, even with all those details, you know, I'd be hard pressed to look at those and know who you're talking about. Right? I mean,
The techie question is just specifically the KidsNet calling the web service. What standard is being used to submit the immunization in either like HL7 or XML? And then what standard is being used to return the recommendations, either HL7 or XML?
As of now, there are no standards for that submission. So it's a proprietary web service that was created for this purpose. There is some activity going on now in HL7 and OMG and IHE to look as HL7 is doing, has done more in the past couple of years on service or oriented architecture. It's actually a project underway now to sort of describe some of this and perhaps create the standards around this, but there really aren't any national standards around how to define the service between these two, you know, the sender and the receiver.
Okay, thank you very much.
Hi, I'm Nicole from Kansas IIS. I have a question for Noam.
Yeah.
We're working on the two-way interface, HL7. We do exchange the OBX recommender. Something we realized recently, and this is kind of a question for you, but also a FYI lessons learned. We send the recommendation. We have one big vendor that does all our local health departments, and I guess there's a little bit more of testing. I'm not sure how much testing you've done in terms of you send a recommendations, but are they interpreting that that send as what you sent it? We realized recently that that vendor wasn't recognizing some of the vaccines beyond we've tested fully of if they receive our coding, our CVX, all that. For some reason, they didn't receive our recommendation in the OBX segment correctly, so they never saw that. Vice versa, in our system, localized, we can say this provider auto-recommends a specific vaccine over the other. Well, you can't translate that in terms of they have to tell us what they want to set in our own system for us to send it back, if that makes sense. So I just didn't know if you've tested in terms of when you send something, are they truly interpreting what you sent?
I mean, our approach has been, and some, I don't know, is Alex here from New York? Maybe she knows better. But as far as I know, our approach has been that, in many ways, that's not our problem. In other words, we even know that some folks using this service can't deal with the decision support recommendations at all. And we expect they will be ignored by receiving systems that make this query. And that's a limitation on the receiving system, that it just, I mean, we know that particularly more general EHR systems as opposed to pediatric-focused ones, you know, have a pretty poor implementation of pediatric functions. So their ability to absorb and display, you know, appropriately and accurately a recommendation may be quite limited. So we know that some receivers will just ignore the recommendation. They're interested in the history, and they'll do whatever they want to do with it. But I don't believe we get involved with their interpretation unless they ask questions. You know, it's up to them to be responsible with the data that they're getting.
Well, in our case, they're actually blaming us as having it wrong. It's like, well, no, really, it's your system. So just an FYI on that.
I think all of us have heard that one before.
Hi, this is also for Noam. So IIS systems, reminder recall systems, are very tightly integrated with the forecast tool. I'm trying to envision how it works. I can conceptualize how querying on a specific patient record, bringing back a specific recommendation, works with this kind of web service. If you're running a reminder recall for a large group of patients, how would that work? Would it be sort of like you're sending a batch HL7 for this group? Or
right.
I'm puzzled.
Well, it is certainly possible to send you know, multiple queries and get multiple answers. In New York City, there are some other facilities that are not HL7 based that provide a way for an insurance plan or a provider to submit a panel of patients and get back whatever matching data they have for those patients. I don't believe that the web service allows for any more than a single patient query, yeah, and a single answer, but I would have to check on that.
Sure. Seems like, yeah. I mean, considering the sophistication of some of the reminder programs, where you can really set a wide range of parameters.
Right.
Sounds like a challenge.
So there are ways to that in New York City that they have to provide that data, and both New York City and Rhode Island have reminder recall functionality in the IIS product themselves. But maybe we can get a few more details from Ms. Ternier.
Actually, you're correct in that, Noam. We do have this functionality, and it's it's being used by our providers. They can also produce a list of for reminder recall based on their patient list that we have in the system.
So, but that's in the IIS. That's not through this sort of services-based query and response. That's Alex from New York.
If, I'm sorry.
I couldn't hear the.
Can you repeat the question?
Yeah, I couldn't hear the question.
We have an up-to-date indicator, and that's what we base it on, not by vaccine.
Right. So you know, a number of years into the registry, we realized that it would be useful to sort of have a literally, you know, yes, no, an indicator if the child is up to date. Because that then becomes very easy to spot, especially if you're looking at a panel of children. So it's the sigma of everything that's evaluated about the child in this sort of one yes-no indicator. So that's updated when it needs to be, and sort of drives their reminder recall inclusion. Thanks, Alex.
Actually, I had a question for Amanda and Janet. I know you didn't really investigate the reasons behind the variances in forecasting. I wanted to know if besides the differential interpretation of the ACIP recommendations, if you had a sense of other reasons that might explain the variances in forecasting.
No, not from the data that was submitted. We recognize that this should be saved for a later conversation.
Okay, thank you.
And last question here from Jerry.
This is Jerry Bragg from State of Michigan. This isn't really a question, but I was just gonna give an example of what we do on the recall side. And in our system for the forecasting, if a record gets touched, it gets assessed, whether a record's reported to it or it's fetched for visual display or pulled up for a report. And we have batch processes that look at records that haven't been touched and reevaluate them and keep them up to date within a 7-day window. And then when we run a reminder, we pull up those candidate records and then we reevaluate them in real time for the reminder. But we've already whittled it down to 3,000. And I think right now we're at about a tenth or 0.2 seconds to assess a record. So we're not able to do 100,000 at a time. And the same issue will come in with the web service. If your response time is 0.1 second, 0.05, it's probably too slow to do massive populations all at once, but you can kind of use some batch capability to keep them to be able to identify candidate records for recall. And then when your recall runs are typically filtered down, you're not sending out 20,000 at a time. You then evaluate that population within that context, and you end up with your end number. So that seems to work pretty effectively.
So thanks, Jerry. Let's have a big round of applause for our speakers up here. I was not disappointed. This was the one I wanted to see the most, and they really covered the bases that I thought was great. So thank you very much.